Last August, I returned to Maine for the first time since I started working on hoarding, and for the first time since my grandma Fontaine passed away. When she died 6 years ago, I thought of her as an eccentric old poet whose house in Massachusetts was, well, she hadn't let anyone into her house in Massachusetts in over a decade, but the last time I saw her house, it was filthy and full. Today, of course, we'd call her a hoarder. A colleague of mine recently said to me, I had a friend growing up whose father was a hoarder. Well, we used to call him an artist, but I guess now you'd call him a hoarder. People like my grandmother, my colleague's friend's father, and my own father, for that matter, have probably been around forever. What has changed is that suddenly, as a culture, we can't stop talking about them. In the last decade, the United States has seen an explosion of discourse about hoarding. Medical research has given name to a constellation of anxieties and practices that suddenly appears ubiquitous, and the proposed hoarding disorder entry represents a critical node in the ongoing revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is due to be published in 2013. The nascent diagnostic category, which experts estimate applies to 2 to 5% of the U.S. population, has given rise to hundreds of support groups for hoarders and their families. In the wake of a series of accidental deaths and residential fires that made national news, local task forces have been charged with exploring ways to reduce safety risks and costs incurred to cities and townships because of hoarding. Far from being confined to the fields of medicine and government, hoarding is everywhere in artistic and literary production of the last decade. From documentary films like Cynthia Lester's My Mother's Garden and Martin Hampton's Possessed, to memoirs like Jesse Scholl's Dirty Secret, A Daughter Comes Clean About Her Mother's Compulsive Hoarding, to the local author Cynthia Omololu's young adult novel Dirty Secrets, and, of course, the three network television series, Hoarders, Hoarding Buried Treasures, Buried Alive, sorry, and Confessions, Animal Hoarding. Not to mention American Pickers, Storage Wars, and Extreme Couponing. I believe that this contemporary interest in hoarding reflects anxieties about the increasing immateriality of memory and experience in the age of digital technologies. It's a hard argument to sustain without producing a logical fallacy of the type, after this, therefore because of this. But I think the relationship is more than coincidental. Discourses of hoarding and digital technologies share a concern with the pace of progress and preservation, and taxonomical troubles that result in organizational systems that rely on temporal rather than thematic criteria. Back to Maine. In Maine, I was hoping to piece together some fragments of my grandmother's life from the dozens of storage bins that my father and uncles had brought up from her house in Massachusetts. A lifetime of letters, photography, poetry, and, as it turned out, junk mail was packed into those bins, and I was eager to rifle through as many of them as I could in the time before the heavy smell of her Maine house became unbearable. The mold and mildew survived both my grandmother and the excruciating cleaning efforts of my father and my uncles and aunts. More generally, I wanted to think about hoarding, both in my own family history and in the culture at large, and I knew Maine was a good place to think about hoarding. I had happy memories of summers spent at my grandmother's house in Maine with all my cousins. We would walk to the town dump during the day and scavenge for toys, then go back at night with our parents to watch from the safety of our cars as the bears did their own scavenging. And just for the record, the bears in Maine are small and friendly. They're not like the ones here. The town dump closed years ago, but there was still plenty of the kind of photogenic detritus that I was hoping to find. Lawns littered with rusty cars, box springs, stoves, and bathtubs. Driving along the country roads between my mother's house and my grandmother's house, we must have passed a crumbling farmhouse full of rotten wood and wheelbarrows, or a Japanese motorcycle garden at least every mile. We stopped at a particularly theatrical one. Upstage, a trailer. the proscenium cluttered with a remarkable array of junk. My mom and I got out of the car and walked toward the trailer where a young woman now stood. I didn't know what to say to try to cover up the fact that I was there trying to take pictures of the hoarded junk. So I asked, "Is any of this for sale?" And she said, "Yeah, you want any of this?" And she was like, "If there's something you want, just ask." And I was like, "Well, would you mind if I take pictures for my blog?" And then she was like, "Well, you can take pictures, but don't take any pictures where you see the full extent of the lawn, because recently a journalist had done the same thing of showing up there and saying, 'Is any of this for sale? Would you mind if I take pictures?'" And so the family was in trouble with the local authorities because the authorities were claiming that they're an unlicensed junkyard. And clearly, if they're trying to cover up being an unlicensed junkyard, they're not doing a great job. I don't know how clearly you can see it, but that sign says, "We buy junk cars." So here are some pictures I took that just show a little bit of junk. That's a bathtub with reflections of leaves. I thought it was really beautiful. So I got some pictures. And then further down the road, we stopped at Nathan Nichols' sculpture garden, which is animals, flowers, people, cars, all kinds of scenes made from rusty auto parts and other scrap metal. I asked him if I could take pictures for my blog, and again, I didn't know quite whether to say, "It's a blog about hoarding," so I also said, "and reuse and found objects and art made from found objects," which is true. But Nathan said, "Oh, hoarding, I have that." And he explained that the reason he started the sculpture garden was because he was getting in trouble from local authorities for hoarding auto parts and scrap metal in his yard, and he figured if he turned it into art, they couldn't really have a problem with it. So these are some of his sculptures, and he has a Facebook page you can fan, and he posts a lot of other pictures of his sculptures. So his name is Nathan Nichols. That's a horse. That's some of the junk that hasn't been made into a sculpture yet. And my mom sometimes goes and drops off boxes of old screws and other metal parts, and he's really grateful to have them. So it's nice to have that kind of recycling center. These are flowers, and that's him with a self-portrait as a lion. So my point is not simply to gawk at the country folk in Maine, though in truth I did do a lot of that. But it does seem noteworthy that what is pathologized regularly on network television is something more like a way of life in rural Maine. It's so normal, in fact, that while antiquing, I stumbled upon this book. It's called The Dump Man's Treasures by the Maine-based writer Lynn Plourd. And today, far from Maine, it seems astonishing that such a book exists. It's a children's book glorifying the practice of picking through trash at the town dump. So I want to provide a brief overview of the book because I think it gets at a critical issue about the materiality of the text in the age of digital technologies. So the book begins, and I'm quoting, "Back when dumps were called dumps, not landfills or recycling centers, way up in the northeast corner of the United States, in the small village of Shiretown, Maine, Mr. Pottle was the dump man. He certainly would answer if anyone called him by his real names, Bill or Mr. Pottle, but most folks just called him the dump man. He didn't mind. That was his job, and he loved it. And oh, the treasures he'd find. Best of all were the books. The dump man wouldn't let anyone throw away a single book. Mr. Pottle offered to fix books. He taped torn pages, glued bindings back on, and set books by the simmering potpourri on his hot plate to hide their musty smells. But still, people threw away books. Mr. Pottle waggled his finger. Shame, shame. Books are treasures. You never throw away treasures. Mr. Pottle," and now I'm not quoting anymore, Mr. Pottle rescues so many books that he decides to start a library at the dump. He builds bookshelves, and children from all over Shiretown come to the dump to read in Mr. Pottle's library. Soon, there are too many books to fit in the library, but still, Mr. Pottle refuses to let a single book go to waste. He begins bringing salvaged books to nursing homes, hospitals, and schools. One day, while making his rounds of book deliveries, he falls into a ditch and breaks his ankle. After the doctor prescribes bed rest, children from all over Shiretown bring him books at the hospital. "Go on, read," they urge him. They wait for him to begin reading, but he just sits in bed, sipping his soup, surrounded by books. "Sorry," the kids apologize. "Did we bring you the wrong books? We can go get different ones." Mr. Pottle shushed them. "No, these are perfect. All books are perfect. It's just, well, I don't know how to read." So the kids read the books to Mr. Pottle, and all is well in Shiretown. It's a sweet story, and I wanted to share it not only because it evidences the extent of Maine's culture of thrift, but also because it introduces the critical split between the materiality of the book as a physical object and the literary text. Though he spends his days doting on books, rescuing those abandoned at the dump, gluing their bindings and taping torn pages, Mr. Pottle cannot read. The split between the book as a physical object and the literary text is gaining new currency in the age of digital technologies. Indeed, a pervasive assumption holds that the inventions of first of writing and then of the printing press represent watershed moments in an ongoing process of textual dematerialization, wherein meaning comes to inhere in the reproducible form of words rather than in gestures, oral performance, manuscript illuminations, and other physical aspects of the text. So when we think of the Divine Comedy, for example, we don't think of the first existing manuscript that we have access to. We think of the text that is reproduced in every edition of the Divine Comedy. And that wasn't always the case, so it's part of this process of dematerialization. In the last decade, many have asked whether digital technologies will prompt a similarly changed conception of the literary text, and if so, what will be lost as such a transformation takes shape? Answers to this second question may already be evident to those who have yet to invest in a Kindle, iPad, Nook, or other reading device, despite the persistent urging of their friends. And yet, no Kindle can offer certain pleasures of the material, the textured scar of a bookworm's repast, the dusty smell of archive time, the practice of reading with a pen in hand, marking up the margins of a text. This sense of loss that accompanies the digitization of the book is evidenced, somewhat paradoxically, by a spate of blogs like The Art of Google Books, which fetishizes precisely the kinds of material traces that are absent from digital formats. And these next pictures I'm going to show are from the blog The Art of Google Books, which is a fantastic blog. So these are all pictures taken from Google Books of the, you know, the traces of a human presence that remain in the digital format. So there's some annotations in the margin and notes. This one is really interesting. It's the, you know, you can see somebody turning a page and the blurriness of a scanning error. And that's an ink stain. And that's some messy scanning, I guess, in ink. So they're really beautiful. And there's a blog dedicated to these errors. So another similar blog that celebrates the book as a material object is the blog Bookshelf Porn, which is much more about interior decorating and architecture than books. So here are three pictures from Bookshelf Porn, which is another blog that, you know, it's called Bookshelf Porn. You can find it. So these are just beautiful bookshelves. And then similarly, there's a new meme that you may have seen circulating recently on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, or, you know, another place where images like this circulate. So that's a quote from John Waters that I've seen repeatedly on Facebook in the last week or so. So what's interesting in these examples is that the celebration of the becoming obsolete takes place on the very medium that augurs such obsolescence. And what these blogs share with Mr. Pottle is a project of preservation. The dumb man and the children refuse to abandon a single book, and so their struggle against the adults of Shiretown resembles the dramas acted out before us today on reality television. Mr. Pottle explains, "Books are treasures. You don't throw away treasures." The children of Shiretown agreed. They wanted to keep every book they'd ever owned, even their baby books. But some parents wouldn't hear of such a thing. "You've outgrown these. We don't have any more room for more books. You've already read them 100 times. The math of the dump man's treasure is simple. Since there are more adults than children in Shiretown, the books keep ending up at the dump. And Mr. Pottle and the young readers are therefore faced with a Sisyphean task like that of the Angel of History of Walter Benjamin's famous allegorical reading of Paul Klee's Angelus Novus. And that's this image. So now I'm going to read you this famous passage from Walter Benjamin's Theses on the Philosophy of History. Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned toward the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing from paradise. It has got caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. This storm irresistibly propels him into the future to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. And I think that the allegory of the angel of history has been used to talk about a lot of things, but the idea of trying to stop the flow of time and take in as much material as possible in order to have some record of progress of the passing of time is precisely what the hoarder is doing. And I don't want to glorify hoarding, I don't want to glorify hoarding, but I think that it's interesting that it's the same structure. So, though Benjamin does not explicitly liken the angel of history to a collector, hoarder, or accumulator, its desire to make whole what is smashed and to salvage debris from an ever-growing pile resonates strongly with contemporary figurations of hoarders. The resemblance is obviously not lost on Sylvia, who's a hoarder and the subject of the short video by Anne Silvio called Too Much Stuff. In the video, Sylvia pauses to point out her self-portrait, which clearly evokes Klee's Angelus Novus. It's very small, but you can see there's Sylvia looking up at a portrait that's a self-portrait, and you can see how much it resembles the Angel of History trying to salvage as much as possible from the storm of progress. So that's a close-up of the self-portrait. Benjamin, too, concretizes the analogy between the collector and the angel of history in the Arcades Project, where he writes, "Perhaps the most deeply hidden motive of the person who collects can be described this way. He takes up the struggle against dispersion. Right from the start, the great collector is struck by the confusion, by the scatter in which things of the world are found." As with Mr. Pottle and the Angel of History, the collector's struggle against dispersion is a Sisyphean task. And for the contemporary hoarder, perhaps in distinction to the collector, although as we shall see, I think if there is a distinction between hoarder and collector, it's malleable. And if I were to make an argument about what differentiates a hoarder from a collector, I would say most simply perspective. And that might be historical perspective, in that somebody who in the 19th century would be a collector today might be called a hoarder. So perspective either of the person diagnosing and the person experiencing the hoarding, or, you know, it's a clash in perspectives, whereas collecting doesn't necessarily have to be. And that's obviously not a helpful clinical way of thinking about the distinction, but it's helpful in other ways, I think. Where was I? So this project of preservation is rendered all the more overwhelming because one of the defining characteristics of the hoarder is an information processing deficit known as underinclusion. And Randy Frost and Gail Steckety, who are the co-authors of Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things, and who are sort of at the forefront of research about hoarding in medical disciplines, they describe this information processing deficit where an obsessionals define category boundaries too narrowly. This underinclusion translates into hoarding behaviors in three ways. First, each possession seems unique and thus irreplaceable. As such, the hoarder is generally unwilling to discard the object. Second, and again resulting from a perception of the uniqueness of each possession, the hoarder is unable to part with a category of objects, such as old newspapers, before carefully examining each one. Finally, because the hoarder is unable to categorize his possessions, he is unable to organize or arrange them. And I'm sure that the organizers in this room who have worked with hoarders probably encountered something like this. So Frost and Steckety explain this process, which may seem uncomfortably familiar to many bibliophiles. And I'm quoting, "An example of this phenomenon can be seen in the arrangement of a hoarder's books. The hoarder begins to read a book, but must stop to do something else. The book cannot be returned to the shelf because it is now in a different category, books being actively read. It is placed on the coffee table. Next, a cookbook is consulted for dinner, and it too cannot be returned to the shelf because it is being used. It is deposited on the back of the couch. The dictionary used next cannot be reshelved, lest the person forget what word he looked up. The process is repeated until there are books everywhere, none of which can be returned to its shelf because they are all in their own different category." So that's under inclusion. "Their new position in the room has meaning because each position represents a different category and an idiosyncratic sort of organization exists, but the ultimate result is clutter and chaos. The finite amount of space available means that possessions must be piled on top of one another until there are large mounds of unrelated objects. From this chaos, a sort of temporal organization emerges. The hoarder may have a sense of where things are placed based on when they enter the pile. So hoarders trying to sort through a pile often pick up a possession and, not being sure what to do with it, say, 'I'll set it here for now,' placing it somewhere nearby. This process is repeated until the piles are so large and numerous that they just kind of reproduce themselves in a process that is called churning, and no real progress is made. The hoarder that emerges from contemporary medical discourse, then, is one characterized by taxonomical troubles of great consequence for narrative, as objects are reorganized temporally rather than thematically. The temporal organization, however, is both subjective and unstable. Things are arranged not according to their date of manufacture or of acquisition, but according to their most recent contact with the hoarder. The information processing deficit of the contemporary hoarder is one that has long preoccupied collectors. In Collecting Paris, Naomi Shore relates a similar problem of categorization that is pervasive in books about postcard collecting. A frequent theme is the bewilderment of the novice when confronted with the multiplicity of categories into which postcards are, by convention, divided. And Mark Singer's New Yorker profile of the polymath book and ephemera collector Michael Zinman suggests a similar concern with categorization at the boundaries between hoarding and collecting. So Singer draws attention to the critical mess theory developed by Zinman and his friend William Reese, and I'm going to quote, "The most intriguing thing is how a collection like Michael's gets built," Reese said, by way of explaining the practical ramifications of the critical mess theory. "When you start on something like this, you say, okay, here's a genre, here's a field, and I'm just going to buy it, whatever it is that I'm collecting. Signs from homeless people, imprints before 1800. You don't start off with a big theory about what you're trying to do. You don't begin by saying, I'm trying to prove X. You build a big pile. Once you get a big enough pile together, you start to see patterns." So the critical mess theory amounts to a declaration that in order to be a collector, you have to first be a hoarder. You have to amass enough stuff in order to see the kind of patterns and organizational structures that would make you a collector rather than a hoarder. The internet, of course, is one such critical mess, right? I'm sure you remember the early days of the internet when Yahoo used a directory system to parse search results. Such a system would be impossible today. As happens in the hoarded home, the material would quickly overwhelm the taxonomic structure. The categories would be untenable. Instead, digital technologies now accommodate precisely the information processing deficits of the hoarder. We no longer need to develop an efficient filing system on our desktops because powerful search engines can quickly locate our files. And you might have seen recent articles in the New York Times or on Jezebel in which the author comes clean about being a digital hoarder. On the one hand, it's sort of impossible to be a digital hoarder unless you have, you know, so many computers and hard drives that your living space is cluttered and you can't function, you know, your day-to-day life is substantially impaired. That would probably make you a digital hoarder. But just having a lot of you know, gigabytes is not, I don't think that really would constitute digital hoarding. At the same time, we're all kind of digital hoarders in that we're sort of increasingly relying on a chronological structure of organization rather than a thematic one. So our inboxes, you know, are, if there is an organization, there is an organization and it's a temporal organization for the most part. And it's the same thing that happens on a blog, as a vast amount of thematically related material gets inserted into a chronology that has, that in a way is sort of irrelevant. I guess with the dates with emails in an inbox are more relevant, but in a blog they might be less so, although I suppose it really depends. So another thing that makes me think that the interest in hoarding and digital technologies are linked is just that in some ways as more traces of our memories and lived experiences are being saved in a digital format, we all probably have some awareness of the precariousness of that format. So if your computer has ever been stolen, or you forgot to back something up, or your computer crashed and you lost a lot of documents, you recognize that this is not the most, it's not entirely stable, and perhaps we would all do well to print out everything on our computers and file them away. It's kind of a preposterous idea, but I think that there is some awareness of the instability of digital formats, and you know, that may produce some of this contemporary interest in people who are excessively attached to the material. So if we wanted to guarantee that in two generations people will be able to, our grandchildren will be able to rifle through our photographs and poetry and letters, we would probably do well to print them out. In any case, our great-grandchildren will probably then throw them out. I mean, it's not, it won't last forever anyway. So on that subject, I want to conclude by reading a poem that I found in Maine while rifling through the storage bins. So this is a poem she wrote, and I think it deals with the materiality of the book and the immateriality of memory. And it's called The Old Book. I found it in the box beside the thrift shop door with the please take sign, free books for the poor, a pictorial history of the Great Civil War. It's a big book, 1,000 pages and more. It's front leather missing, it's not much to look, but I saw at a glance that it's my kind of book. Its porous rag paper is soft to the touch and tanned with age. I like it so much. Being written shortly after the strife, its pages bring the whole sequence to life. The war impending, the preparations, the sneaky tricks and deviations, the battles in Congress and false words spoken, the rupture of friendships and promises broken. With engravings of battles and generals, too, it details what happened the whole war through. In April of 65, Grant tendered military terms and Lee surrendered the largest army of the South. Abraham Lincoln, with joy in his mouth, a man who had no bitter feeling, spoke to all of peace and healing. But Abraham Lincoln was killed by a gun before full peace had even begun. We can then add what we know well, the pains of our forebears that no book can tell. For highlights of pain have been passed along like fragments from an old lost song. Thank you.
A question and answer period follows. Since all the questions were off mic and practically inaudible, I'm going to restate them.
Yeah.
It seems like the difference between hoarding and collecting is money. If you have money, you're a collector, and you can afford to keep your stuff. But if you're a hoarder, it's usually because you're poor.
Well, I think that's a great point, and there's a great cartoon about it that if you want, I can email it to you or something, but it's a really funny cartoon where it's a picture of the same woman in a closet full of, like, fancy shoes saying, I'm a collector, I collect books and shoes, and then another woman, the same woman, but made to look less wealthy, saying, I'm a hoarder, I hoard shoes and books. So there is that. I think on the one hand, it's a question of, in that comic, it's less a question of the people actually having money than the perception, like the name calling that we do. So it may be that no matter how much money you have, you can still be a hoarder. But if they're rich enough, we would call them collectors instead of hoarders. But I also think that that's kind of a problematic way of thinking about it, because hoarders, there is really something different about the acquiring that goes on when you have somebody who has a serious tendency to hoarding, and no matter how much space they can afford to fill up, they'll fill it up. So I don't know that it's all about money, but I certainly think that our perception is that way. And it doesn't help that on TV, you know, all the shows about hoarders are usually about hoarders who don't have much money. And that's simply because the reason you would decide to subject yourself to that is because you're facing some immediate threat by a town that's threatening to charge you for, or, you know, to jail you for criminal, whatever, yard clutter, you know, stuff like that. I mean, there's a financial incentive of airing your story on national television, which is more appealing to people who don't have as much money. So, yeah.
It seems like the difference between hoarding and collecting is money. If you have money, you're a collector, and you can afford to keep your stuff. But if you're a hoarder, it's usually because you're poor.
Right. Well, that's why I think it's a question of perspective. And there is sort of a cultural consensus about the value of what a collector collects. So we recognize that it's that there's more value there, whereas we don't recognize that for a hoarder. But a hoarder will still say, "Oh yeah, I collect these. Oh yeah, I collect those too. Like, oh yeah, I collect those." I mean, it may be less intentioned, but it's still, you know, there's some intentionality to it, I think. Yeah.
Do you have a sense that hoarders use the computer differently?
Huh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I know my dad seems always like strangely, he works in a kind of technology field, and yet he's completely overwhelmed and anxious around computers. So I hadn't thought of that, but that seems like it would be like a critical thing to look at in trying to make the case for it relating to digital technologies. Yeah.
Well, back to the hoarder and collector discussion. I thought the difference was that a collector cares about what he collects and takes pride in how he displays it, regardless of the value, you know, be it a postage stamp or whatever. Whereas hoarders often have a lot of stuff and they don't care if it's molding or rotting or if it's not in the best condition. It's basically just clutter to the hoarder.
Right. Well, I mean, good collectors, let's say, would, like, presentation is an important part of it. And I think, you know, presentation certainly is not important to the hoarder or the hoarders that I know and have read about. But I think that the question of squalor and the question of shame, of the hoarder's shame and of the squalor of the hoarder's abode might be overstated. There's actually, I think, more recent studies have shown that they're not, that squalor is often not present in a hoarded situation, nor is shame. And, you know, some of the like, well, in Jessie Scholl's memoir, it doesn't seem like her mother is particularly ashamed to have people in the house. Jessie Scholl is more ashamed. In Omololu's young adult novel, though, shame is an important part of it. My dad is almost like boastful of all the stuff at his house. It's like you can see a sense of resignation and sadness, but there's also a sense of pride. So I'm not sure. Yeah.
Are there any studies about hoarding and how that might affect memory?
Well, I think the studies that have been done about hoarders suggest that their memory is just as good as anyone else's, but they have a lot more anxiety about not being able to access their memories. And so they rely more on these physical traces of their experience. So in terms of the actual memory, there is not much clinical scientific evidence that it's in any way different, but anxiety is a part of it. And actually, it's the same with money. In terms of the actual socioeconomic status of hoarders, the studies that have been done, and there aren't that many studies because, you know, the term hoarder has been around for a while, but it only became this sort of pathologized type of person in the last 10 or 15 years. I think 1996 was like the seminal study. But regardless, the studies that have been done suggest that there really is no discrepancy in socioeconomic status between hoarders and non-hoarders, but hoarders have more anxiety about the possibility of having limited resources. So again, it has more to do with anxiety than any actual difference. Yeah.
Have you done a study on the difference between urban and rural settings?
No, but that would be interesting. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I think of hoarding as being so important to the culture of the area of Maine that I go to, but it's also such an important part of, like, the mythology of New York. Like, the Collier brothers are legendary, and so many people in New York, live in such small spaces for such a long time because they're rent controlled. And I mean, I'm sure anyone who's lived in the same place for more than 5 years or something has noticed that it gets full. So I imagine it would be that much worse in a very, very small space for a very, very long time. But it would be interesting to look at. Yeah, over there.
Is there a word for the opposite of hoarders? You know, those who throw things out compulsively, even though they might not have to.
Well, like, I mean, okay, that's a funny thing, too, because on the one hand, you often see, like, in the contemporary discourse of hoarding, there's this idea that it's kind of the like, pathological extreme of capitalist culture, right? So hoarding, for some people, is the epitome of that. At the same time, like, the idea of throwing things, I mean, in a way, there's something that's incredibly, like, prudent about hoarding, you know, and trying to make the most of the possessions you have. And so I think that contradiction gets caught up in your question, which now I'm, like, blanking. Sorry. Oh, yeah, well, it's the question of OCD. Like, at first they thought hoarding was another kind of OCD. So throwing things away to that kind of extreme and hoarding, you know, if it is one symptom of a certain or one manifestation of obsessive compulsive disorder, then absolutely they share, you know, a common structure. But more recent studies have been suggesting that they're not as linked as people originally thought. And the OCD cases of hoarding, you have more like hoarding unusual objects, which means like feces, hair, fingernails, like bodily waste. Whereas the people who don't have OCD symptoms with hoarding may hoard less unusual things. So, yeah.
Is hoarding something that runs in families? Or I guess what I'm saying is it partially genetic?
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the case.
Well, is it genetic or is it something that you learn?
Right. Let's hope it's that. Or, you know, because then I could have learned from my mom, not my dad. I don't know. It does seem to be in families. Yeah, in the back.
Has there been an investigation to the ties hoarding might have to Depression-era conservation and that sort of frugality and preservation of everything you have?
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's sort of, it's interesting because during the Depression and also during the autarkic period of fascist Italy, which is what I'm writing my dissertation about, hoarding was not this kind of individual pathology. It was prudent. And it was also an economic problem. What we're thinking of today has no bearing on the economy. Like, these are sort of lone people, like, very isolated existences that really have nothing to do with the larger economy. So I think during the Depression and during autarkic Italy, hoarding was a concern. There was a lot of discourse about hoarding, but it was a completely different kind. And the question of whether, I mean, I think today people think about, it being the generation that survived the Depression that are most likely to hoard. And that has been questioned by the study that found that it has little to do with socioeconomic status. But again, there aren't that many studies because people have only been talking about this for like, you know, 15 years. So we'll see. And I mean, it seems hard to believe that there is no relation, especially because you would think that going through something like the Depression or a period of scarcity would produce precisely the kind of anxiety that is linked to hoarding, even if socioeconomic status is not directly linked to hoarding. So.
Well, okay. Thank you. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.